Luke chapter number 6 is where we are at this morning as we continue on our series in his gospel that he wrote, inspired by the Spirit of God. Luke chapter number 6, if you're not familiar with where that's at in a copy of God's Word, that's okay. If you open it about to the middle, you're going to come across Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. You start going to the right this way, you're going to come across Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans, or just pull out your phone and Google Luke chapter 6. That's a good thing as well. Our emphasis on that is that we want you to see right from the Bible what God has for you today, for me today, because he cares about us. He loves us more than we could ever possibly understand in this life. So we're in Luke chapter number 6 as we continue on our study. And this morning, we're only looking at 4 verses. And everybody said, oh, that's a short sermon. I can feel it already. Yeah, you're close. You might be right. We're talking about this subject. The idea of this, help wanted and on-the-job training being available. I want you to look at Luke chapter number 6 and verse number 12 with me. And I want you to read what seems to us maybe a really ubiquitous or odd moment here in Luke's gospel, but we'll walk through why it mattered then, why it mattered to the church, and why it matters to you and I today as well. So I want you to look at verse number 12 with me. It says this, it came to pass in those days that Jesus went into a mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. And when it was day, Jesus called unto him his disciples, and then he chose 12, whom also he named apostles. So there's a group of people who are his followers, and he looks at those followers, and he selects 12 out, and he calls them apostles. He has Simon, who's also Peter, Andrew, his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, Simon called Zelotes, or Simon the Zealot, if you would, Judas the brother of James, and Judas Iscariot, note his words here, which also was the traitor. This morning, we're going to talk about this idea that we see from Luke's gospel, I help wanted with on-the-job training available. When I read this passage, it got me to thinking about ideal candidates and spokespersons in our society all around us. I do enjoy and watch some sports, and what's taken the college scene by storm the last few years is name, image, and likeness, NIL money. And so with NIL money, it means college students can take up branding and get paid for that branding. So you'll have all these college athletes now shilling everything from burritos to tires to everything, right? And so they're getting their NIL money while they're in college. And so you'll have some guy not look like me because they're an athlete, but you get the idea. Some random guy to you maybe, and it's like, hi, do you need new tires on your ride? Join me down at Tire Center, right? And so he's like this really awkward, maybe goofy spokesperson, maybe not ideal for the product, but it's a partnership they've gotten because of maybe a platform or notoriety they have. I think about some of the other commercials I've seen lately. I've seen like Travis Kelsey, whatever his last name is, and he's partnered with Pfizer to help us get our cold vaccines and our flu vaccine and anything else, right? And so we have a football player being our spokesperson in that. What my point is with this, you wouldn't typically choose the most unfit person to be the face of your product, business, campaign, or launch. You would want somebody who fits what you're trying to do to draw others to what you're trying to do, whether it's to sell them or get them on board in a cause, right? Maybe we could think about it like this. I'm from Texas originally. Imagine a scene with me. Re-elect Sheriff Jones comes on your TV, and all of a sudden it pans to some old boy in his overalls. Of course, he has no shirt on, just his overalls, right? He has his hands not in the pockets, but inside, resting on his belly, and he's got a nice flowing mullet. And they go to him, and they're like, why should we re-elect Sheriff Jones? Well, I reckon he's good people and all. He has put a crimping on my moonshine in business. He did put up my brother Buford last week for selling wild boar out of his cooler. But overall, he lets us be with our casino in the house in the basement there. So he's good. Let's re-elect Sheriff Jones. Like if you saw that commercial and that campaign, you would wonder who is in charge of that and how long until Sheriff Jones is not re-elected for that. Right? The idea being, as a stupid illustration, that we want those to represent us, who are like us. As human beings, we want those aligned with us ideologically. We want people who seem to embody the values we do. We want them to present well in a way that's acceptable to us and to society to get people on our side or on our bandwagon or engaged as investors. But Jesus, as we've seen him doing all of the end of chapter 5 and into chapter 6 in his early ministry, he doesn't act like you and I do. He doesn't make the choices you and I would make. He does things contrary to what would be, quote, natural and smart and wise to us. He breaks all the rules. In our passage last time, we saw the religious leaders, they get Jesus all wrong. And that's what religion always does. It gets Jesus all wrong. They had elevated something and someone else in place of him. And so Jesus corrected their perverted worship of the Sabbath by reminding the hearers and us now as readers of the purpose of the Sabbath and him as our creator of it. Now, here we come to Luke chapter 6. He doesn't record what Matthew does in chapter 12 or Mark does in chapter 3, where they record Jesus withdrawing to the Sea of Galilee. We suspect it was that area with his apostles, and this multitude follow him and get healed. He talks about that later on in verse 17 here in Luke. But he doesn't record that the Gospel of Matthew says Jesus does all this in fulfillment of Isaiah chapter number 42, where Jesus will be a servant to all, offer salvation for anyone, particularly including non-Jewish people or Gentiles. Now, Luke and Mark in his gospel record the selection of the 12 apostles from the group of disciples. Jesus here intentionally selects apostles from various lifestyles, various backgrounds, various everything to accomplish his unique task for the church with the gospel. And if there's an encouraging thought we could walk away with as we see Jesus select the 12 apostles that became the foundation for the church and the gospel movement throughout that region and obviously its impact to today, here's what it'd be. I want you to remember this. Jesus, he saved you and is accomplishing his work through you, not because of who you are, but because of who he is. Now, as we go through these 12, some of you may be familiar with them, some of you may not be, but I want this thought to drive into your brain and settle in, that Jesus saved you. If you're here and you don't know Jesus, he's willing to forgive, change your life in eternity, and save you, deliver you from what you rightfully deserve forever. He's willing to save you and change you and transform you, not because of what you brought to the table, but because of who he is and what he's able to do and what he desires to do for you and for me, for really anyone. So what's the scene here as we come to this passage? Jesus has obviously been healing. He's been teaching. He's been correcting. He's been doing these things on the Sabbath, out in public, in the synagogues, the places of assembly there for Jewish people on Saturdays. And so here he is. He's going out to the region to go and pray. To give you an idea of what it could have looked like if he's in the Galilee region, I want you to think about these pictures here. You can see them. This might have been kind of the scene of where he's praying. This is on the east side of the Galilee there on Mount Arbel. These are easily accessible hills there, maybe take you a little bit to walk to it, but this is likely something where Jesus is praying, some like place where Jesus is praying. And catch this, he is praying all night. Like, we could have just stopped there and done a thematic sermon about prayer, and I think all of us walked away feeling like sorry dogs, right? Maybe this morning, the best we got into prayer was 20 or 30 minutes. Jesus prayed all night. This is a little side note, not in the message, but we're just going to put it right here. As you start your new year, there's all these resolutions, and there's maybe good ones. Maybe you need to go to Starbucks less. Maybe you need to not eat out as much. Maybe you need to have some protein shakes along the way. Maybe you need to stop your subscription spending. Maybe you need to cancel your Amazon. Maybe you need to, I don't know. Here's one thing I feel pretty confident all of us could do better about and need to assign more time to. We could probably pray more, couldn't we? we probably rely and depend on God a lot more, right? So Jesus here gives us this example, and this isn't the first time, nor is it the last time Jesus will give us this example of the importance of prayer. Now, Jesus gave this example and model as he was God in flesh, showing dependency and submission to the will of the Father for your salvation and my salvation, and he goes here and spends the evening in prayer. He is there praying, and this is not uncommon for him because he does this before what I'd call significant or monumental moments. Of course, we know he prayed all night before he went to the cross. We know that. But there's other occasions where he prays all night because of the monumental nature of what is ahead of him. So that ought to give you an idea of just how critical the juncture is and the plan of God for the gospel to go through the church that Jesus is establishing, that he spent all night in prayer before he selected from this group of disciples 12 people to, if I can put it this way, represent him and be the leaders of the church, the gospel endeavor. So he calls the various disciples up. He's prayed all night. The crowds in front of them, they're disciples, people who are being disciplined under the teachings and ways of Jesus as a rabbi, but as the Messiah. And as they're there and there's a crowd, he selects 12 people as he calls them up. And then he commissions them. He commissions them to go forth. You see this in Mark's gospel. We'll see it next time in Luke's gospel. He commissions them to go out on his behalf with his authority. And what are they to do? They're to go out and teach about Jesus, preach about Jesus, and call people to salvation from Jesus, leaving their religious ways, leaving their worldview, leaving what they've been dependent upon, leaving what they've been living their lives based upon and hoping for. And they leave that to become a follower of Jesus as well. If that weren't enough, Jesus says, I'm not only giving you the message with my authority, I'm giving you the means which you'll give deliverance and miracles in the midst of those who you preach and teach to. So these apostles are going to go out and heal the sick. They're going to go out and cast out devils. All it's going to be done in the authority of Jesus and the truths of his teachings going through them to the hearers. Again, I can't stress this enough. It's not because of who they are. It's because of who he is. The beauty in this that we should take note of is that he chose them to be apostles. They didn't stump for it. They didn't put out a resume for it. There was no jostling and jockeying to get selected as an apostle. It did not rest in their ability. It did not rest in their pedigree or their status. It rested upon the work of Jesus alone. Maybe I could try to illustrate it like this. Growing up, we had family friends who had Dairy Queen franchises. Now, that's not a big thing around here. There's like one or two in sketchy spots in this area. But in the South, they are everywhere. And in the South, they have a whole different menu that we as Midwesterners do not even know about. I'm talking about like a steak finger basket. You don't even know what that is? It's okay, but you're missing out. They own this chain or this series of franchises. And if we were visiting them, whether we were with them or with their kids or whoever it was, if we walked in the door of one of their franchises, guess how much you needed your wallet? This much. You want a burger? Get a burger. You want a blizzard? Get a blizzard. You want an ice cream cake? You're going to take two bites out of it and not finish it? Get an ice cream cake. Why? Well, it wasn't based on what we offered when the Nortons came in and saw it like, oh, it's the Nortons, quick, get them something. No. It was based upon who owned the store and how they ran it. It was based on their care, their provision, not our status, our pedigree, or our financial ability. Here, this is what's happening in this passage. Jesus is selecting apostles and sending them out. That's what the word apostle means, sent one. And he's sending them out on this mission and endeavor with a message that's not theirs, ability that's not theirs. It's all been stewarded to them because of the ability of Jesus Christ, who the message is about, and who is granting the power to accomplish the miracles. So then we get to the selection. And it makes us ask ourselves as we read through it, who are these fellows and why did it matter? Who are they and why did it matter? Well, in the New Testament, Jesus selects the apostles, and there seems to have been at least two criteria. Some could bicker about three criteria. But if you were going to be an apostle here, and then later on, as we'd see in Acts chapter number 1 and 2, and then eventually with the apostle Paul in the book of Galatians, we'd see this. To be an apostle meant you had to have been an eyewitness of the risen Christ, 1 Corinthians 9, and you had to have been commissioned to proclaim the gospel by Jesus Christ. And so that's what it meant to be a sent one, that's generically, but then specifically for the work of the church. The original 12 and Paul fit the purpose and intent demonstrated in their lives and in their service to Jesus. Now, I want you to consider the primarily Jewish audience here and understand this, as one author said. Most interpreters assume that Jesus intended the number of the apostles to correspond with the 12 tribes of Israel, indicating, therefore, that there is a new people of God being brought into existence, a new vehicle through which he's going to accomplish his divine, eternal work in the affairs of everyday people like you and like me. And so in all these various lists that you have of the apostles, it's interesting to note there's always four lists, and each of them have three groups of four led off the same way with the same names. That's something you could look up later just to show maybe there was some structure, there's some clarity, and there's some seniority in the apostles and how they were. So who are they? Some of you are well familiar with this. Others may not be as familiar with who the apostles are. So for some, you're going to be familiar and encouraged. For others, it might be brand new, and that's okay. That's good. Who are these apostles that Jesus selects from all the faces standing in front of him? He starts off with Peter and Andrew. Now, this is a sibling set. These are brothers, an older and a younger brother. What could go wrong, right? Sons of John. They were born in Bethsaida, that's up in the northern part there of Israel, and they eventually relocate to almost the northern part exclusively called Galilee, the Lake of Galilee region. Those pictures that we just showed were from that area. These guys grow up. Their dad's a fisherman, from what we can tell. They take on the family business. They become fishermen as well in that northern region. We understand from what we can tell scripturally and historically, they seem to be somewhat educated. I wouldn't call them overly educated. I would not call them completely illiterate. They are somewhat educated, as they need to be for the fishing business and the market business. And so we have them somewhat educated in that northern region. They both seem to be anticipating what the Old Testament talked to them about. They learned about the Messiah would come, a Savior would deliver them, not only nationally, but spiritually forever. So they've been anticipating a Messiah coming. Andrew had been a follower of John the Baptist, the precursor of the Messiah, the forerunner, and now they've been following Jesus. They leave their life of fishing. They leave what would be an easy trade to live out. You're never going to get wealthy, but you're always going to be okay. They leave their life of what should be stable finances, leave their life of community engagement and involvement there to be sent ones for Jesus Christ. Some might say, what did this net them, going from being disciples to apostles, and Jesus is risen, and now they are on the scene, the face of the church? What did it net them? Well, there's traditional belief that both were crucified for being followers of Jesus, both under the reign of Nero. Some speculate even somewhere around the time of Paul and his beheading. So they left their life of following their father's footsteps in fishing to ultimately end up being grotesquely murdered in public for being a follower and a proclaimer of Jesus. Who's next? Another sibling set. You have James. And you have John, again, another older brother and younger brother situation. They're similar to Peter and Andrew. They grew up in the same area. They have the same background, the same familiarity, the same pretty much everything outside of parents, right? The northern region here is where they live. And so both these sets of brothers live in that north area. And though it's not geographically that far from the southern area of Israel, like Jerusalem, etc., and Bethlehem, it still is very different. How's it different? I'd maybe try to liken it like this in our context that we could understand. You have people from the north, and you have people from the south in America. They're not always the same, are they? They don't think the same, they don't talk the same, they don't act the same, right? And sometimes it can be comical. You have the coasts. You have the East Coast, and you have the best coast over there. And they're wildly different in often in their ideology and how they interpret life and what they do with their lives. Now, catch it. Same language for the most part, English predominantly. Same country, same government. But their day-to-day life, north, south, east, west, radically different in some ways in their approach to and living out of life. So catch it. The first four that are recorded here are all from the northern region of Israel that's just different than the hustle and bustle down south of Jerusalem and that being much more of an epicenter of Roman control. So you have these four and their brothers as well, and they come from what we might, if I could say it this way, sounding unkind, more a blue-collar background. And what did Andrew and Peter get? Death. What do James and John get? Well, James is the first disciple to be martyred. He's killed in Acts chapter number 12. You have his brother John exiled to the island of Patmos under the reign of Domitian until Domitian died. Then John was allowed to return and minister there in the area of Ephesus. So you have three guys martyred, one guy exiled, and then finally allowed to return in his old age. We move on and we see Philip. Philip's interesting. What do we know about Philip? Pretty much nothing. Well, that doesn't seem right. Jesus would choose somebody more important than that, somebody we had more background about. I think in the wisdom of Jesus, he selects people on purpose to emphasize the point again, it's not about what we bring to the table. It's about who he is, what he's able to do in and through your life. Though Philip is Jewish, we only know him by his Greek name. We know, as we see demonstrated in the Gospels, he has a heart for evangelism. He has a heart for getting other people to hear about the message of Jesus. You can look at John 1:45 and see that later. He was close to somebody else named Nathanael, and they both anticipated the coming Messiah. History tells us, as accurate as that might be, some of this is tradition, it's hard to know to a certainty, Philip was stoned and then crucified after a stoning in the area of Hierapolis, Phrygia, the Galatia area of that time. Then there's Bartholomew, his friend, Nathanael, if we could say it that way. He came from the region of Galilee as well. What we are exposed to about him is he's devoutly religious, and therefore in his religious thinking, he is very angry and prejudiced towards certain people. So you have a Jewish man very prejudiced towards anybody who's not Jewish and not Jewish the way he thinks they should be Jewish. And he expresses that in John's gospel, John chapter 1 and John chapter beginning and end, you see that. So he's very devout, he's very sincere, he's very passionate, but he's very wrong in how he views people, and Jesus changes that. How much does Jesus change that? Well, there is some idea that Nathanael is one of the first people to press east and even translated Matthew's gospel into the dialect spoken in India that time, and he was ultimately beaten, crucified, and beheaded in Armenia. So he, for his efforts, receives the same fate as so many others. Martyrdom. We kind of change gears here. Matthew is mentioned. Matthew was unlike the other fellows. They're more familiar with northern Israel. Matthew is down south, kind of in the center, the epicenter there. He's a tax collector for Rome, so they're under Roman occupation. They need local people to do a lot of the interacting, be the face for Rome. And so he's there collecting money for their occupiers, and he's also able to extort his own countrymen for his living to go up, his lifestyle to go up, his bank account to go up. So there could be no more despised person almost in the nation of Israel than Matthew. He'd be considered, if I could say it this way, a total fraud. Just a total fraud, a traitor to his people, and somebody that God despises for what he was doing for the nation or the empire of Rome. And yet Jesus says, You can be one of my sent ones, not because of what he brought to the table, but because of the transformation and change Jesus could do in and through his life. It's recorded that Matthew brought the gospel down to Ethiopia and Egypt and was ultimately killed, martyred, by having been run through with a spear. Now, At this point, I think you're starting to catch a pattern, aren't you? Apostles, sent one, very prestigious, yes. Sent ones, not based on your abilities, absolutely. Granted a message and authority that few others would enjoy, absolutely. But what was the price tag, humanly speaking? Not adoration. Not grandiose living. Suffering, rejection, pain, persecution, and then usually some type of martyrdom. I don't know if you guys remember, I think Easter last year, the Babylon Bee put out something. There's a funny video just showing how the stupidity of people who say, you know, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is all folklore and the disciples are all folklore. And they just made a funny joke about how the disciples are like, we got this great plan. We're going to steal his body, lie about it, and then we're all going to get murdered for following him. Oh, you know, like this is a great plan. Obviously, it's a terrible idea. And it would not make sense in any other context unless Jesus is who he claimed to be, can do what he promised he would do, and change their life and eternity. So you have people like Matthew. You have people like Thomas. Usually we call him what? Doubting Thomas, right? Thomas seems to be a bit of an outspoken skeptic. I just want to pause and say this. If you're here today, young or old, you're familiar with church, unfamiliar with church, your first time here, you've been here a long time, Jesus, he can withstand and even welcomes criticism and skepticism. I think sometimes we as Christians feel we're trying to defend Jesus. He doesn't need your help. He loves for you to articulate clearly about him. He loves for you to be ready to answer about your faith. But he is the way, the truth, the life. And so he always welcomed and interacted with skeptics. And I'm encouraging you and I to do the same. And parents, train your young people to do the same. Here you have Thomas, somebody who struggled at times with skepticism, kind of a I'll believe it if I see it type of a thing. And when Jesus is resurrected, what does he do? I'll believe it's Jesus when I can put my hands here, and I can put my hands there. And when Jesus appeared, it kind of changed the story for Thomas, didn't it? My Lord and my God. Tradition strongly suggests Thomas started a Christian church as far east as maybe what we call India, and he was also run through with a spear and martyred for his efforts. You have James of Alphaeus, except for a few details about his family, we know nothing about him as well. The only thing we think we know, and this is sketchy at best in my mind, is that he was crucified in the Sinai region or possibly stoned to death in Jerusalem. Again, somebody we don't really know, somebody that didn't make waves in human history, but somebody that Jesus utilized in the founding of his church, in the gospel endeavor going forward, who met what I'd call a very difficult or cruel end. You have Thaddeus or Judas, the brother of James. Most traditions say that he took the gospel north. He took the gospel north and saw a king that you can look up historically called Abgar, him be healed and him become a follower of Christ. Eusebius, the church historian, recognizes that and records that for us. But it says for his efforts there going north with the gospel, far beyond Jerusalem, far beyond Israel, that he was clubbed to death for being a follower and a proclaimer and going against the religion of that region. You have Simon the Canaanite, or maybe we're familiar with him as a zealot. What was a zealot? It was a Jewish person who embraced very radically the idea that no one should have a higher authority and kingdom on this world than the nation of Israel, and that one day the Messiah would return and he would be the warrior king they'd been waiting on. He'd depose all other governments. So zealots in their time sought to be, if we could say it, the insurrectionists or the guerrilla groups to do all they could to make Roman life difficult and uncomfortable. Maybe we could put it this way. He was a political activist, maybe even an armed political activist. Are you catching what just we heard? Matthew, complete compromiser and sympathizer to government occupiers, is going to be sent alongside of who? A zealot, a political Jewish activist. This is never going to work, Jesus. This is a terrible idea. There's no way people change like that. You can change their environment, but you can't change what's in them. You know what some of that saying is? But that's the difference with Jesus. He transforms you and I from the inside out.
teaching us all the faulty ideas, beliefs, and ways of living we used to be so dedicated, even fiercely loyal to. And he reforms and regenerates and changes and transforms us to recognize what's true spiritually about him, about us, about eternity, about this life, about other people. People maybe we naturally before would have hated, despised, shunned, done anything to avoid. Jesus changes this man, the zealot, to where he can even be a part of a group of 12, that's pretty small, with a former government sympathizer. What did Simon the zealot receive this? After preaching, it seems, in northern Africa and pressing west perhaps, he went up towards Europe after coming through that region. And it seems historically that he was crucified somewhere around 70-74 A.D. Last needs maybe no introduction. It's the other Judas. Oh, that guy, right? Somebody who heard the message of Jesus but wasn't changed by the message of Jesus. Somebody who followed Jesus, wanted Jesus to become the warrior Messiah and be a king, wanted Jesus to establish a kingdom that he could have a position in, wanted Jesus to be opulent so he could kind of be in that inner circle as well. And so Jesus here has somebody in his midst who is not a follower at all. Outwardly, looks the part. Inwardly, has never put his faith, his dependence, his reliance on Jesus. Judas is a scary and stark lesson that you can know about God. You can do the God stuff like we're doing right now and have no relationship with him at all. No change. No eternity granted with him. You may be able to rattle off the right answers, but not know what it is to be transformed from the inside out. Jesus selects Judas. I want you to catch this. He's intentional about his selection of his apostles. He chooses them from various lifestyles to accomplish his unique task for the church with the gospel. I'll say it again. Jesus saves us and accomplishes his work through us, not because of who we are, but what? Because of who he is. Think about who's represented here in this group. We've given kind of a background biographical sketch, but I want you to think philosophically or thematically what it was like, or socially even what it's like. Think about it. You have white collar versus blue collar. You have educated and maybe somewhat illiterate. You think about white collar alone. Peter, James, John, Andrew, the clash of ideas about money, how you use it, how you feel about not having it, how you feel about those who have it, how you feel about those who don't have it, what lifestyles you're used to because of having or not having it. And you have in this group of 12 people who are used to certain things and ideas about the other party. They're now sent ones because of Jesus. In this same group, you have the educated and somewhat illiterate. Depending on what area they came from and what access they had, they have these influences on how they think and how they interpret others. And now they're mushed in this group together. We've already emphasized it. There's quite the political spectrum in this group. Never serve Rome ever, all the way to, yeah, if they pay me enough, I'll serve and do whatever they want done. Doesn't matter to me. You have religiously different people. People not looking for the Messiah at all, looking at all religion like it was just a hoax and a fairy tale and something just to kind of keep a moral check in place in society versus those devout and passionate about what could be happening religiously. If that were enough, you have a variety of personalities. You get to see some of this borne out in the New Testament in their interactions. Think about people like Peter and James and John, names we're more familiar with in the Gospels. Brash, outspoken, taking the lead often. They are problem-oriented. There's an issue, let's care for it. There's an issue, let's deal with it. There's an issue, how are we going to change it? How are we going to solve it? Yeah, people more like Andrew and John. They're more people-oriented. Yeah, there's a problem, but let's talk about the people first and deal with them. You have this clash, if you could say, of personality types, and then you have what would happen even historically with them. My point again with saying all this is it's for us to remember Jesus' intentionality when selecting the disciples and then the apostles. I would submit to you, it's because the devil and our flesh work constantly to undermine what Jesus has made clear and true in our lives as disciples. Why is it important for us to take time on a Sunday morning on New Year's Day to look at four verses, see some what feel like 12 random names, and talk about them and get to know them a little bit and what mattered in their life before meeting Jesus and then after meeting Jesus? Because it's important for us to remember how Jesus selected them, why he selected them, how he transformed them, and what he did through them. And I would submit to you and I today, it's important for us to remember that you may not be an apostle of Jesus Christ. You weren't selected and sent, but you are a disciple of Jesus Christ, and he is working in and through your life. And I want you to remember that he's the one doing the work, and he didn't save you based on your pedigree. He doesn't work through your life based on what you bring to the table. He does it because of his desire, his good pleasure, and his work accomplishing it. What that looks like in our lives is constantly under attack from our archenemy, the devil, and then even our own flesh, our own part of us that wants to give in and indulge in sin. What it sounds like and what it looks like is different for each one of us. What do you mean? I don't know what you struggle with as being a follower of Jesus. I don't know what the devil comes and whispers to you. I don't know what your own flesh pulls on you with. But maybe I could try to help us think about why it's important we remember, center, and anchor ourselves to Jesus being the one who called us, Jesus being the one who saved us, Jesus being the one who changes us, rather than get off track on some other goofy thought pattern or metric. At the risk of sounding narcissistic or self-loathing, let me give you an idea of what sometimes I struggle with in my own thoughts and how I have to come back to what it is to be a disciple and follower of Jesus. I'm not the follower I imagined I'd be at this age. I've been a follower of Jesus over 20 years, and I can look at how Jesus has changed so many things in my life, and my thoughts, and my choices, and victory over sin he's granted. And I'm nowhere near what I thought probably I'd be at 40 years old. You'd think after following him 20 years, things would be different in some ways. So sometimes I find myself discouraged, frustrated, angry at myself, right? I'm not the husband I believe my wife deserves. We've been married 18 years, and I feel like I'm still trying to figure out, and now I'm often a big flop of a husband. I often think I've failed in showing my daughters what it's like to have a heavenly father who cares and loves them in their life, that my care or my choices are a frail example and direct them towards them. I often feel like a failure of a dad, perennial dad guilt. I often struggle with whether or not FBC would just be better off with a different lead pastor. Maybe the church would do better, grow more. It'd make a difference. It'd make an impact. You'd do better spiritually if I wasn't in the way. You say, why do you have those type of thoughts? Well, I'm a sinner and frail, number one. But then number two, what must I do with those types of thoughts? I have to do what we're called to scripturally. I have to evaluate them biblically. Are these thoughts true? Then I have to ask myself, who am I following with these thoughts? Who am I looking to with these thoughts? Whose disciple am I? Am I passionately growing in my love of Jesus? Who's called me to be his child? Who decided to give me the gifting I have? Who is changing me? Is there some area of grace I need to embrace to be transformed? And am I saying no and quenching that? My point with saying all that is, if we're disciples of Jesus and he wants to do in and through our lives what his good pleasure is for our betterment and growing with him, but making an impact beyond these doors to those who are not followers of Jesus, realize the devil's going to attack that. Our own flesh is going to attack that. And we even see that lived out in the 12 apostles, that there was personal and plural bickering and frustration. And they had to keep coming back to, who is Jesus? What has he done? What is he doing through us for his glory? Here's my encouragement to you today. as you start a new year, right? It's tomorrow's a new year, which means the gym will be slammed and everybody's going to be drinking like fruit smoothies for a week, maybe 3 days tops. We have all these plans, right? Here's my encouragement to you, brothers and sisters. If you are a follower of Jesus, you are his disciple. Keep being discipled. Stop letting yesterday, the failure, the choice, the whatever it was, stop letting yesterday control you today. The disciples would not have gone very far. The apostles would not have been very far sent if they constantly went back to yesterday. Stop letting expectations for the future bring uncertainty about following Jesus today. You can't control what is going to happen, who will be in your life, how your life will be going in the future, but you can have and seize today. Stop letting perceptions of what you should be or what you should have accomplished paralyze you from the simple choice of today with Jesus. Today with Jesus and what that looks like with your spouse if you have one. Today with Jesus and what that looks like with your kids if God's given you any. What that's like with your coworker tomorrow, not tomorrow, maybe Tuesday, your neighbor, your church, etc. You get what I'm saying here? The devil and the flesh are going to try to fight everything they can in your life as a disciple. We have to be anchored to Jesus and what he's desirous to do. Can I say this? Lastly, stop waiting for the perfect scenario to materialize and act in faith-based obedience to Jesus today. So often we're waiting for this perfect ethereal moment, this perfect painted moment to happen. So then, today be a disciple. None of these apostles got where they were in perfect fashion, perfect moments. It was step by step. Faith-based obedience by faith-based obedience, repentance when needed, and faith-based obedience step by step. As I look around this room today, I'm reminded there are no perfect stories, yours or mine. But I want you to know I don't see a room full of failures. In fact, newsflash, as a pastor, I don't want to see people in either boat. I don't want to see people who feel their abysmal failure, and I don't want people who think they've got it all put together and have need of nothing. Both are spiritual ditches to your detriment. My desire for you in this new year would be this: embracing the opportunities God has given you uniquely. Enjoying the riches of Jesus that he's given you to enjoy not only a relationship with him, but accomplish his purposes in and through your life. What does that mean for you and I? It might mean clipping the idolatrous strings that tug at us, that tug at our time, that tug at our heart, that tug at the Lord's money that he's granted us in our lives. And we may need to clip some strings and then embrace the freedom and enjoyment of living on an eternal mission that he's granted us. Jesus here intentionally selects these apostles, all from these various lifestyles and backgrounds, and puts them together to accomplish his work through his church for the gospel. I say it to you again. Jesus, he desires to save you, or you have called upon him and you know what it is to be saved. And he is accomplishing his work in you, not because of what you brought to the table, but because of who he is and what he brought to the table for you and has granted to you freely. Today, you don't have to be everything you wish you were or think you would be or think Jesus expects you to be. You need to be available, teachable, yielded, and obedient. Well, what about, can you just be those? Well, what about in the past? Can you be those? If so, he will use you in unique and phenomenal ways that we don't even know or anticipate. This morning, if you're a follower of Jesus, I want to encourage you, take a step forward, say no to what's pulling on you that's untrue, say yes to what is true about Jesus and his work in your life. If you're here or watching online, you don't know what it is to be a follower of Jesus, to be forgiven and enjoy this radical change, even change that would lead people to lose their physical life with abandon. If you don't know what it is to be transformed eternally and relationally, I want you to know there's hope and change today for you.